enemy soldiers Cliff Booth was responsible for? Their answer would be, who fucking knows? But once there was widespread speculation that in 1966 Cliff Booth killed his wife, his status as a war hero became the second thing he was most known for inside the stunt community. Number three on the list of things that Cliff Booth was known for inside the stunt community were his talents as a ringer. As a ringer, Cliff Booth was the best in the 60s film industry. What's a ringer? Don't try looking it up. It's an unofficial term. Well, say you're a stunt gaffer, and you're working with a real asshole director who yells at your dudes all the time. Or with some fucking dickhead actor who keeps tagging your dudes and blames them for his mistake. Now the stunt gaffer, or anyone on his team, can't knock the director's block off or punch the actor back when they get tagged. But what the stunt gaffer can do is hire a stunt player for the day, not one of the gaffer's team. And that dude is a ringer. And he can do what the stunt team can't, which is basically fuck the shit out of the asshole, preferably in front of the whole crew. Say you're working in the broiling hot sun of Mississippi for a year with that bald Nazi bastard Otto Preminger on Hurry Sundown. And that sadistic prick has belittled and berated crew members in front of the whole company for an entire year. So, you hire Cliff Booth as a stunt day player and have him purposefully fuck up a shot in front of Otto. Then you and the crew just sit back and enjoy the show. Booth socked Preminger, mid-tirade, in the jaw, knocking him flat in the Mississippi mud. Cliff's excuse was, as a World War II hero, he experienced a wartime flashback when Preminger yelled at him in his German Gestapo accent, and he forgot where he was. And when the production manager gave him his bus ticket home the next day, Cliff left Mississippi with an extra, off the books, $700 in his back pocket. And that night, celebrating with the crew at the hotel bar, he never had to pay for a drink. Or say you're part of the stunt team on the Western TV series, The Wild, Wild West. Now, series lead Robert Conrad prides himself on doing a lot of his own stunts. Well, that may be more or less true. But while performing his own stunts, he really didn't mind how many stuntmen got hurt in the process, especially when it comes to tagging stuntmen during fistfights. Tagging, definition, accidentally punching somebody for real in a staged fight, which he never took responsibility for. It was always their fault. They weren't where they were supposed to be. They were the ones that were unprofessional. It was their fault he hurt his hand. He did this to such a degree that in the stunt community, he earned the name Robert Never Met a Stuntman He Couldn't Blame Conrad. So it was considered a grand and glorious day when Cliff Booth, with an accidentally mistimed haymaker, knocked Bob on the ass of his skin-tight pants. A couple of stuntmen wept. Again, Cliff Booth left the set with $700 extra in his back pocket and a case of beer in the trunk of his car. Then, while shooting 100 rifles on location in Almeria, Spain, in a bar, he became the only known white man to ever win a fistfight with Jim Brown. Now, as cool as the Jim Brown story is, it's the one that might be mythic horseshit. For one, it's doubtful during the time Jim Brown and Burt Reynolds were in Spain making 100 rifles that Cliff was there as well. He was probably with Rick shooting his Bingo Martin episode. Later in 1969, both Rick and Cliff would go to Almeria to shoot Red Blood, Red Skin with Telly Savalas. Also, the legend of a white man winning a fistfight with Jim Brown might just be that, a legend. Supposedly, it's either A, Cliff in a bar in Spain on 100 rifles, B, Rod Taylor in Kenya on the set of Dark of the Sun, C, Rod Taylor again, not on the set of Dark of the Sun, but at the Playboy Mansion in front of the fountain, or D, it never happened. But the set fight Cliff was most infamous for was the friendly contest between himself and the most renowned martial artist of all time, Bruce Lee. At the time of what came to be known in Cliff's career as the Bruce Lee incident, Bruce wasn't as yet either a movie superstar or a legend. He was just the actor who played the Green Hornet's sidekick, Kato, on the TV series The Green Hornet, a cheap jack show made to cash in on the popularity of the Batman TV series. But in the Hollywood community, even more than for his role on the TV show, Bruce was mostly known as Karate Coach to the rich and famous. Karate Coach is how Hollywood would have referred to him, not how Bruce would have referred to himself. The way celebrities would later work out with personal trainers in their backyard for one-hour sessions is how Steve McQueen, James Coburn, Roman Polanski, Jay Sebring, and Sterling Siliphant all took classes with Bruce at home. It's a little funny to think that one of the most talented martial artists of all time would choose to spend his time teaching Roman Polanski, Jay Sebring, and Sterling Siliphant how to throw a straight leg kick. It's a little like if Muhammad Ali spent a large portion of his time giving James Garner, Tom Smothers, and Bill Cosby boxing lessons. But Bruce Lee had a game plan in mind. Like Charles Manson, this spiritual Sifu stuff was just a side gig. The way Charles Manson wanted to be a rock star, Bruce Lee wanted to be a movie star. James Coburn and Sterling Siliphant were his Dennis Wilson. Steve McQueen and Roman Polanski were his Terry Melcher. Every fourth training session with Roman Polanski, Bruce brought up The Silent Flute, the script he was trying to get made with Oscar-winning screenwriter Sterling Siliphant, who, like Dennis Wilson with Charlie, truly believed in Bruce's potential, which would star James Coburn and Bruce playing four different roles. Bruce even accompanied Roman and Sharon on a ski trip to Switzerland to try to get Roman to commit to the project. As if Roman Polanski would follow up Rosemary's Baby with a pretentious James Coburn action picture. Roman seriously liked and respected Bruce. He even admired him. But whenever Bruce brought up the silent flute, he diminished himself in Roman's eyes. In fact, it made Roman think about how Hollywood brought out the worst in people. One difference between Lee and Manson was Bruce had what it took to be a phenomenon. Not at the time he was acting on The Green Hornet, but a few years later, first in his Hong Kong movies with Lo Wei, then in his big Warner Brothers martial arts extravaganza, Enter the Dragon. But back in 1966, when he was still playing the Green Hornet sidekick Kato, Bruce Lee had a reputation amongst the American stuntmen who worked on his show. A bad one. Bruce Lee didn't have much regard or respect for American stuntmen, and the actor went out of his way to make that disrespect obvious. One of the ways was tagging them with his flying fist and feet during fight scenes. He was warned about this time and time again, and like Robert Conrad, he always had an excuse that made it their fault. To such a degree, a whole host of stunt players refused to work with him. Now, truth be told, Cliff didn't like Lee from the first moment he laid eyes on him, which was before Rick started shooting his guest villain gig on the show. The first time Cliff witnessed Lee's screen fighting technique was when the stuntman drove Rick to the 20th Century Fox lot for his wardrobe fitting for the following week's episode. The two men stood back away from everybody and watched Bruce and his co-star, Van Williams, shoot an outdoor fight scene, where Lee performed a lot of dazzling Quicksilver kicks and Nureyev-like leaps. When Lee was finished, the crew broke into applause. Rick was definitely impressed and turned to Cliff and said, "That guy's really something, huh?" Uncharacteristically, Cliff snorted dismissively. "That guy ain't fucking shit. It might as well be Russ Tamblyn out there. The guy's a fucking dancer. Send Twinkle Toes back to West Side Story." Rick countered, "That guy's fast as fuck. Those kicks are great."
"They look great. In a movie," Cliff schooled.
"There ain't no power in that shit. Yeah, he's fast, I'll give you that. But fast patty cake is still patty cake. None of these karate faggots are worth a shit in a real fight. Judo's a little different. With judo, you deal with a guy who don't know what he's doing. You can toss him around a little bit. But none of these karate faggots have any power in their kicks. And not a single one of them can take a punch to save their life." Then Cliff points at Kato for emphasis. "Least of all, that midget there." Cliff rarely went on a tear, so when he did, Rick let him rant himself out. "Hand-to-hand combat, man. That's where it's at. A fucking green beret would scramble his eggs. Everything he does is for show. Everything Ali or Jerry Quarry does is to inflict punishment. Everything a green beret does is to kill. I'd like to see that faggot in the jungle fighting a Jap who outweighs him by 30 pounds with a knife in his hand and murder on his mind," Cliff snorted. "That happens. The Green Hornet's looking for a new chauffeur." "Okay, look," Rick offered. "Maybe in a kill or be killed situation, you might be right." "I am right," Cliff interrupted. "Nevertheless," Rick continued, "those fast kicks are impressive." "Stretching," Cliff said dismissively. "It's all stretching. I come over to your house and stretch you out for 3 hours a day, Monday through Friday. In 3 months, you can do every fucking thing he can do." Rick gave him a skeptical look, and Cliff backtracked a bit. "Okay, maybe not everything, but close enough." The fight between Cliff and Bruce occurred when Cliff was on the set of the Green Hornet, doubling for Rick. Bruce, as usual, was holding court with the crew about his prowess. And then somebody asked him the single question that people asked Bruce all the time. Who would win in a fight between him and Ali? Bruce was constantly asked this question. And depending on the time and his mood, his answer was different. Later, on the set of Enter the Dragon, when John Saxon asked him the question, Bruce supposedly said, "His fists are bigger than my head." But Bruce admired Ali's ability and made it a point to study 16mm films of Ali's fights. And in examining those films, he made a discovery. Ali dropped his left. In a boxing ring, he knew Ali would murder him. But frankly, Bruce felt there was nobody he couldn't defeat in a fight. The trick would be to fight Ali without boxing gloves and to allow Bruce kicking privileges. So when asked on the set of The Green Hornet that day, he said, "If put in a room and told anything goes, I'd beat him senseless." And Cliff, this day player stuntman, laughed. Bruce asked him, "What was so funny?" For one small moment, Cliff tried to deflect the confrontation. "Hey man, I'm just here to do a job." But that wasn't good enough for Bruce. "But you're laughing at what I'm saying." "But I didn't say anything funny." "Yeah, you kinda did," Cliff smirked. A pissed off Bruce asked the stuntman, "What do you think is so funny?"
Okay, here it goes, Cliff thought. I think you ought to be embarrassed to suggest you'd be anything but a stain on the seat of Muhammad Ali's trunks. All eyes on the set shifted to Bruce. But Cliff, who knew from this point on his job was kaput, felt he might as well get his money's worth, so he continued. A little squirt like you is gonna beat the heavyweight champion of the world senseless. A fucking actor is gonna beat Ali senseless. Fuck Ali. Jerry Quarry would pound you like a nail. Let me ask you something, Cato. Have you ever taken a serious punch? An angry Bruce answered back, No, I haven't, stuntman. Because people can't hit me. That's what I thought you'd say, Cliff said. Cliff looked to the wide-eyed crew members watching all this. I can't believe you buy the horseshit this squirt's dishing out. Turning back to Bruce, Get real, man. You're a fucking actor. You get a black eye, the fight's over. You get a loose tooth, the fight's over. Jerry Quarry will fight 5 rounds with fucking Muhammad Ali with a broken jaw. You know why? Because he's got something you don't know shit about. Heart. Bruce, in his chauffeur's outfit, took a cool guy pose, looked at the ground, shook his head, then looked at the stuntman and smiled, saying, You got a big mouth, stuntman, and I'd really love closing it, especially in front of all my friends. But you see, my hands are registered as lethal weapons. That means we get into a fight, and I accidentally kill you. I go to jail. Cliff came back with, Anybody accidentally kills anybody in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter. And I think all that lethal weapon horseshit is just an excuse so you dancers never have to get into a real fight. Okay, now that was an actual challenge. Made in front of a handful of Bruce's colleagues. So Bruce offered Cliff a friendly contest. 2 out of 3 falls. Nobody tries to hurt anybody. Who just ends up on their butt? You got it, Cato, was Cliff's reply. Under the excited eyes of the crew, the two men prepared to face off against each other. What Bruce didn't know was, Cliff loved 2 out of 3 challenges. Though they usually took place in the parking lots of bars at 1 in the morning, whenever Cliff engaged in this style of contest, especially with somebody who had some fight training, he deployed a sneaky technique that was so obvious he surprised it always works. The technique is simple. He gives them the first fall. He offers very little resistance and prepares himself to withstand whatever they give. He offers so little resistance that the opponent, especially if they're a skilled fighter, assumes Cliff is just some ballroom tough guy in way over his head. Cliff also knows in this type of contest his opponent will use whatever moves or combination of moves he's the most confident with. So after the first fall, Cliff's opponent has usually shown him his big move. And if Cliff appears untrained and the guy's confident about putting Cliff away, 19 times out of 20 the other guy will use the exact same move again. And now that Cliff knows what it is, he waits for it, counters it, and drops the fucker on his ass. From Bruce's perspective, he had no intention of hurting this loudmouth honky. He just wanted to shut his big mouth and make him look a little foolish in front of the crew. For one, It would mean big trouble for Bruce if he hurt this guy. The stuntmen were already complaining about Bruce hitting them and were informing Randy Lloyd, the stunt gaffer, that they didn't want to work with him. Plus, from showing off on the set, Bruce had accidentally dislocated a set designer's jaw with a mistimed kick. If Bruce broke anybody else's jaw on the set, his ass would be grass. So the little dragon decided the best plan of action was something that would look good but ultimately wouldn't hurt the guy. Just knock him off balance. But at the same time, show this asshole a demonstration of who he was dealing with. A spinning roundhouse kick to the ear would take this fucker's head off and maybe make it hard for him to do arithmetic from that point on. A straight leg power kick would knock him clean over the car behind him, and God knows what would get broken. But along with Rudolf Nureyev, Bruce Lee had the ability to hang in the air, unlike few who had ever lived. Nureyev and Lee seemed to sail through the air, accomplish their task, and when they wanted to, land softly on the ground. So Bruce decided a sail-through-the-air leap that contained a lot of height but little forward thrust was the safest move. He could catch air, look damn cool, then stop his flight by tapping his foot on the asshole's chest area, knocking him backward, dropping him on his butt, and teaching this motherfucker a lesson. And that's exactly what he did. Knocking Cliff right on his butt to the applause of the crew. The blonde stuntman looked up from the ground with a goofy smile on his face and said, "Nice leap, Twinkle Toes." Then as he got off the ground, he said, "Do it again." "Okay, now I'm going to put my foot through this fucker's chest," Bruce thought. "I just got to make sure this asshole doesn't break his tailbone when he hits the ground." So with less height and more forward thrust, he took his second leap at the stuntman, who pivoted his body at the last minute, and the master martial artist practically fell into his waiting arms. Then Cliff, holding on to his leg and belt, swung the martial artist like a cat, hard, into a parked car on the set. Bruce heard a crunch sound emit from his lower spine when he smashed into the automobile, and his shoulder blade caught the passenger door handle. He was really hurt. Looking up from the cement pavement, Bruce saw the honky stuntman smiling down at him. Bruce really didn't want to hurt Cliff. He just wanted to show him up. But Cliff wanted to hurt Bruce. If by slamming him into that car, he had fucked up Bruce's back and neck for the rest of his life, Cliff would have been fine with that. As Bruce picked himself off the ground, he watched Cliff take his fighting stance for the third round, and he recognized it as a military hand-to-hand combat stance. Bruce was mad as hell at this fucker for hurting him, but also, for the first time, he saw his opponent for what he was. He wasn't just some cowboy stuntman redneck. Bruce knew Cliff knew what he was doing. Bruce realized Cliff had suckered him into taking him lightly and into doing the same move twice. Bruce could have gone at Cliff in 14 different ways that the stuntman never could have blocked. But by pretending to be an untrained lunkhead, Cliff caused Bruce to go the lazy way and play right into the stuntman's hands. If Cliff's response hadn't have been so vicious, Bruce could have almost admired it. Bruce also quickly recognized that while Cliff wasn't anywhere near as skilled as the opponents he fought in any of his martial arts tournaments, he was something they weren't. He was a killer. Bruce could see Cliff had killed men before with his bare hands. He could see Cliff wasn't fighting Bruce Lee. Cliff was fighting his instinct to kill Bruce Lee. The martial artist often wondered if the day came that he found himself in a kill or be killed situation with a skilled fighter, how would he respond? Well, it looked like that day was today. Fortunately, the third round was broken up by the stunt gaffer's wife, just as it got started. And as he knew he would be, Cliff was quickly fired. The problem with all this was when Cliff was brought on the set of The Green Hornet, it wasn't as a day player ringer meant to give Kato a public spanking. He was just meant to double Rick during the actor's guest star gig. The stunt gaffer, Randy Lloyd, didn't want to hire Cliff in the first place, because Randy believed Cliff was guilty of killing his wife. And Randy worked with his wife, Janet, who very much believed Cliff was guilty of killing his wife. And frankly, they'd rather hire someone for a job who they didn't think was guilty of killing his wife. There were a lot of transgressions people could forgive, especially in the 60s. But a stuntman who killed his wife and tried to break the back of the TV show lead in front of the crew wasn't one of them. After the Bruce Lee incident, for all intents and purposes, Cliff stopped being Rick's stunt double and started being his gopher. Rick was so mad about the whole Bruce Lee incident that Cliff thought he was going to fire him too. But then who would drive Rick to work? Sure, he could find somebody to do it, but at the end of the day, it was just easier to forgive Cliff. Rick paid Cliff a nominal salary to drive him places, do odd jobs, and be available when he needed him. A salary that was supposed to be augmented by getting stunt gigs. But after the Bruce Lee incident, the already meager stunt work he got, due to the speculation in town that he was a murderer, dried up even more. The Hollywood stunt community didn't need another reason not to hire Cliff. But now they had one. And it was Cliff who gave it to him. Rick's little story that morning about the prick AD on Battle of the Coral Sea was actually quite apropos. However, Cliff knew that one of the most interesting things about Hollywood was, ultimately, it was a small fucking town. One of these days, on the street, in a parking lot, in a restaurant, or at a red light, he was going to see that little prick Bruce Lee again. And on that day, ain't nobody except the police gonna be breaking it up. Having finished putting back Rick's TV antenna, and with nothing better to do until around 7:30, when he'll pick his boss up from the set, Cliff is driving Rick's Cadillac down Sunset Boulevard on his way to the movies. As Cliff sits parked at a red light, visualizing knocking Bruce Lee's block off, he glances to his right at the Aquarius Theater with its huge, colorful, painted mural of the hit stage show Hair. And he spots two of the same hippie girls he saw this morning, including the saucy tall brunette number with the pickles who locked eyes with him and flashed the peace sign. Both girls stand in front of the Aquarius with their thumbs stuck out, trying to hitch a ride. The brunette is still dressed the same way she was this morning. Cut off Levi's, crochet halter top, bare feet, and a coat of filthy grime. The brunette hippie pickle girl spots Cliff in a different car from this morning, across the street, going in the opposite direction. She smiles, waves, points at him, and squawks, "Hey, you!" He smiles at her and waves back. She yells across traffic at him, "What happened to your Volkswagen?" He yells across traffic back at her, "This is my boss's car." She holds out her thumb. "How about a lift?" Tugging her thumb. Cliff points his finger in the opposite direction. "Not going my way." She shakes her head sadly and yells, "Big mistake." He yells back, "Probably. You're going to think about me all day," she warns. He yells back, "Probably." The light on Sunset Boulevard turns green, and traffic starts moving again. He gives her a little salute, and she gives him a sad little girl bye-bye wave as the cream-yellow Cadillac drives off. When he gets to Sunset and La Brea, he makes a left and drives down La Brea Boulevard. Sam Riddle, the lunchtime disc jockey on KHJ Radio, reads the copy for a commercial for Tanya Tanning Butter. Not tanning lotion, which protects you from the sun's harmful rays, but tanning butter, which accelerates burning. Cliff drives past Pink's Hot Dogs on the corner of La Brea and Melrose. There are so many people outside crowded around the hot dog stand, you'd think they were giving away free pussy, not selling overpriced chili dogs. Cliff moves the Cadillac into the right-hand lane and makes a right when he gets to Beverly Boulevard. He drives a short distance down Beverly and pulls up in front of a little movie theater and parks the car. In the 30s, the cinema was a vaudeville house called Slapsy Maxie's. In the 50s, it was where Martin and Lewis first performed in Los Angeles. Later, in 1978, it will become a revival house called the New Beverly Cinema, showing repertory films. But in 1969, it's called the Aero Cinema, and it is one of the erotic cinemas of Hollywood. The Vista, located where Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard meet, is another. Not pornographic films, which would later be labeled XXX, but just sexy movies, usually from Europe or Scandinavia. The Eros marquee reads, Carol Baker double feature, The Sweet Body of Deborah, rated R, plus Paranoia, rated X. Cliff climbs out of the Cadillac and buys a ticket for the show at the box office. He makes his way down the darkened aisle and finds a seat in the middle of the fourth row. On the Eros' silver screen, Carol Baker is doing a sexy dance to tom-tom drums, dressed in a skin-tight emerald catsuit. Cliff throws his moccasin-covered feet over the back of the chair in front of him. As he settles down in his seat, he looks up at Carol Baker, sashaying her big green hips from side to side. My God, he thinks, she's big as a horse. Then he smiles, just the way I like 'em. Chapter 14. The Wrecking Crew. The 8-track tape player in Sharon Tate's black Porsche is playing Francoise Hardy's first album in English, Loving. The track that's coming out of the sports car's stereo speakers is Hardy's version of the Phil Oak song, There But For Fortune. Sharon loves this song. And as she sits behind the wheel of the Porsche driving down Wilshire Boulevard, on her way to Westwood Village, she sings along with it. Show me the prison, show me the jail. Show me the prisoner whose face is growing pale. And I'll show you a young man with so many reasons why. And there but for fortune may go you or I. Tears run down her cheeks as she sings. The actress is out running a few errands. She picked up some dry cleaning. 3 short, modish dresses, whose hems reach down to Sharon's upper thigh, and Roman's blue double-breasted blazer hang on clothes hangers wrapped in clear plastic on a hook behind the passenger seat. She also picked up a pair of chunky-heeled platform shoes from a tiny shoe repair shop located on Little Santa Monica Boulevard. And now she's off to run her final errand of the day. She ordered a first edition of Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles as a present for Roman. And the sweet old man who runs the store called the house yesterday to tell her it had arrived. So, singing along with Mademoiselle Hardy, enjoying an anxiety-free cry, Sharon races toward Westwood Village. She spots the young hippie girl standing on the side of the road with her thumb stuck out about a mile after she turns onto Wilshire from Santa Monica Boulevard. The waify hippie looks pleasant, and Sharon is in a pleasant mood, so she thinks, why not? A year later, the answer to that question would be, because that hitchhiker could murder you. But in February 1969, even people who have something to steal, like Sharon in her cool black Porsche, don't feel that way. She pulls up to the curb in front of the sweet-looking freckle-faced hippie, hits the button to lower the passenger side window, and informs the hitchhiker, I'm only going as far as Westwood Village. The young girl bends over with her butt stuck out to look through the window frame at the driver. This young girl may be a free spirit, but she's not just going to climb into anybody's car. But upon seeing the beautiful blonde behind the wheel, the hippie's smile grows wider and she says, "Hey, beggars can't be choosers." Sharon smiles back at her and tells her to climb in. The two young women chat easily together during the 13 minutes it takes for Sharon to get to Westwood Village and park her car. The hippie girl calls herself Cheyenne, and she's hitching up to Big Sur to meet up with a bunch of friends. They're going to attend an outdoor music festival where Crosby, Stills, and Nash, but no Young, will perform, along with the James Gang, Buffy St. Marie, and the 1910 Fruit Gum Company. Sharon thinks it sounds like a lot of fun. If it was 2 days later after Roman left for London, she'd consider driving Cheyenne to Big Sur and joining her and her friends for the concert. She might not actually do it, but she would consider it. Sharon's always had an impulsive streak. Roman does not. And it's one of the few things that make her cooler than her hip movie director husband. As they drive the 13 minutes together, they speak of Big Sur and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, listen to Francoise Hardy, and eat sunflower seeds out of Cheyenne's small leather pouch. "Well, bye-bye. Have fun at Big Sur," are Sharon's last words to Cheyenne as she hugs her farewell in the pay parking lot behind the Westwood Village Theater, where a large six-sheet poster for Roman's friend Michael Sarn's film Joanna is fly-posted on the wall. Then, while Sharon strides into Westwood Village to complete her errands, heading west, the little hippie girl continues on her California adventure, heading north. As Sharon's white patent leather go-go boots walk past head shops, coffee shops, pizza parlors, and newspaper vending machines giving away the Los Angeles Free Press, she removes the big black bug sunglasses from her purse and puts them on to shield her eyes from the glare of the California sun. As she moves toward her destination, she notices her new movie, the Matt Helm secret agent adventure film comedy The Wrecking Crew, is playing at the Bruin Cinema directly in front of her. The big marquee reads, "Dean Martin as Matt Helm in The Wrecking Crew. E. Summer, S. Tate, N. Kwan, T. Louise." Smiling as she crosses the street, she stops in front of the drawing of herself on the film's poster. She looks down the poster to the credit block and finds her name. She reaches out her finger and traces it. After enjoying seeing her name, looking at an artist's rendering of her swinging on a wrecking ball by a cartoon Dean Martin, and appreciating that the movie is playing at one of the premier Westwood houses, she trots past the cinema to the bookstore four shops away. In Arthur's Rare Books for Sale, the sound of the Classics IV's Stormy emanates from the radio behind the counter. The moment Sharon walks through the doors and hears Dennis Yost's lead vocal, her body relaxes in response. Along with Art Garfunkel, Dennis Yost of the Classics IV has the prettiest voice in current rock and roll, Sharon thinks. And she thinks David Clayton Thomas of Blood, Sweat, and Tears has the sexiest. "What can I do for you, young lady?" asks Arthur. As she removes the sunglasses from her face, she greets the old man behind the counter. "Yes, hello. I'm here to pick up a first edition you called me about." "What book?" he asks. "Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles. I ordered it a couple of weeks ago." Then she clarifies, "It's under Polanski."
"Whoa, boy," Arthur says. "Now you're talking books, kiddo."
She lights up. "I know. Isn't it wonderful? I'm getting it as a gift for my husband."
"Well, your husband's a lucky fella," says Arthur. "One, I wish I could read Tess of the D'Urbervilles for the first time again. And two, I wish I was young enough to be married to a pretty little gal like you."
Sharon smiles once more and reaches out across the counter to touch the old man's spotted hand. He smiles, too. As the Classics 4 continue to play in her head, Sharon exits Arthur's store and walks back to her car. Her long coltage legs move her white miniskirt down the Westwood Boulevard sidewalk, approaching the cinema where her movie is playing. Sharon starts to move past the cinema and cross the street, but she doesn't make the green light on the corner, forcing her to cool the black heels of her white go-go boots. With her back to the cinema, the rare first edition in her hand, staring at the red traffic light, something snags Sharon from behind. Something that keeps her from crossing the street when the light finally turns green. Almost like a trout caught on an invisible fishing line, she turns around and walks into the courtyard of the Bruin and examines the lobby card display out in front of the cinema. One lobby card has Dean with Elkie Summer. The lobby card next to it is her and Dean peering over a wall, spying something intriguing. In the photo, Sharon's dressed in a cute baby blue outfit with the adorable blue cap with the fluffy ball on top, which she wore through the whole last 45 minutes of the picture. The next lobby card is another one of her and Dean. It's a photo of her first entrance in the movie. On the lobby card, she's lying on her back in the middle of a hotel lobby in Denmark, having just performed a comedic pratfall with Dean bending down to assist her. Boy, she remembers that day. She was so nervous. None of her other acting jobs had ever required her to be funny, let alone perform slapstick. This was a first. And being a klutzy bumbler was the entire conception of her character. It's why she took the part. But that didn't make her any less nervous the first time she was meant to fall on her ass for comic effect. Not only that, but she had to do it in front of Dean Martin, who spent 20 years watching Jerry Lewis fall on his ass. So if she fucked it up, Dean was gonna know it. Now, both Dean and director Phil said she did a good job with the pratfall. And they should know, right? Still, both of them were such gentlemen. Even if she had done a bad job, it's not like they were going to tell her. Sharon isn't insecure about the whole comedic performance. She does think she eventually got the hang of the slapstick. She's just not so sure of that first tumble. Is she really funny, or is she sexy little me trying to be funny? How's a bombshell to know? The audience, Dingbat, she thinks. The audience either laughs at the gag, or they don't. The sign on the box office booth window reads that the showtime is 3:30. She checks the thin gold watch on her slender wrist, and it reads 3:55. Well, that's okay. That's around when she enters the picture. Holy shit, really? Sharon thinks. Do I really have time to watch the wrecking crew in the middle of a late afternoon and still get ready for this Playboy after dark horseshit I have to do tonight? Well, now, wait a minute, Sharon. Just 40 minutes ago, you were pumping yourself up about how spontaneous you are when compared to Roman. If not for Roman, you'd be driving to Big Sur right now with Cheyenne and dancing barefoot in the mud to Crosby, Stills, and Nash. But you're going to stand out on the sidewalk and have a debate with yourself for 12 minutes about whether or not you're going to see your own movie. Sharon, she thinks, you're a goddamn hypocrite. One, please, she asks the cute, curly-haired, rubber-faced girl enclosed behind the glass cube in the box office booth. 75 cents, she answers back through the metal vent in the middle of the glass box. Sharon starts to dig in her purse to produce 3 quarters, then stops herself when a thought enters her mind. If I'm in the movie... The curly-haired box office girl's forehead shows thinking lines. What do you mean? She asks. I mean, she explains, I'm in the movie. I'm Sharon Tate. My name's on your marquee. I'm S. Tate.
The curly-haired box office girl's eyes raise. You're in this? She asks slightly incredulously. Sharon smiles and nods her head. Yes. Then adds, I play Miss Carlson, the klutz.
She moves over to where the lobby cards are on display and points at the one with her and Dean peering over the wall. That's me.
The box office girl squints through the glass in the box office booth at the lobby card picture, then back up to the smiling blonde. That's you?
Sharon nods her head.
Uh-huh.
But that's the girl from Valley of the Dolls,
the curly-haired girl points out. Sharon smiles again and shrugs her shoulders and says,
Well, that's me, the girl from Valley of the Dolls.
The curly-haired box office girl is starting to see it, but she has one last issue. She points at the lobby card and says, But you have red hair in that.
They dyed my hair, Sharon tells her.
Why? The curly-haired box office girl asks.
The director wanted the character to have red hair, she answers.
Wow, the curly-haired box office girl exclaims. You look prettier in real life. Now, for the record, if you're ever walking down the street and you see an actress you recognize in real life, and you think she looks prettier than she does in the movies or on television, fight the temptation to tell her so. Because it's not something actresses like to hear. It makes them feel insecure. But Sharon knows how pretty she is, so while it bugs her a bit at the end of the day, she doesn't really mind.
Well, giving the box office girl an excuse, I just got my hair done.
The box office girl yells out the open back door of the box office booth at the day manager, Reuben, who's standing in the Bruin lobby.
Hey, Reuben! Come out here.
Reuben steps outside into the Bruin courtyard as the curly-haired box office girl points her finger at Sharon and says,
This is the girl from Valley of the Dolls.
Reuben stops and looks at Sharon and asks the box office girl, Patty Duke. She shakes her curly head and says,
No, the other one.
The girl from Peyton Place? He asks. She shakes her curly head again.
No, the other one.
Sharon chimes in on the guessing game.
The one that ends up doing dirty movies.
Reuben recognizes her.
Oh, she's in our movie,
the curly-haired girl tells him.
Oh, says Reuben again. She's S. Tate,
says the curly-haired box office girl.
Sharon Tate.
The actress corrects, then corrects herself.
Sharon Polanski, actually.
Now, fully up to speed, Reuben turns into the gracious manager greeting a celebrity patron.
Welcome to the Bruin, Miss Tate. Thank you for coming to our theater. Would you like to come in and see the show?
Could I?
She graciously asks.
By all means. He says as he makes a sweeping gesture with his hand to the cinema's open front door.
Sharon walks through the lobby and opens the door leading to the darkened auditorium. As she was dicking around with the curly-haired box office girl in the glass booth, she prayed she hadn't missed her entrance and her comedic pratfall. As she enters the auditorium, she can hear the rotation of the reels on the film projector in the booth above her, and even the slight tick of the 35mm film print running through the projector film gate. She loves that sound. Back in Texas, when she went to movies at the theater on her dad's army base, or when she went to the local cinema in town, the Azteca, either with her girlfriends to see something like Splendor in the Grass, or when she was enlisted to take her little sister Deborah to see the new Disney movie, or at the Starlight Drive-In with a boy to see the new Elvis or Beach Party movie, and invariably engage in a slight wrestling match as she tried to watch the movie and he tried to make out. Sharon never thought about movies as film, or frankly, movies as art.
Movies weren't art. Not like the Thomas Hardy book in her hand. They were just a fun thing to do. They were entertainment. But being with Roman had convinced her film can be art. Roman's Rosemary's Baby isn't art like Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles is art. But it's still art. Just a different kind. She's read the book of Rosemary's Baby, and she's seen Roman's movie. And Roman's movie is more artful. Nor had she ever realized that certain directors make their films with the same power that great authors do. Not all directors. Not most directors. None of the directors she's ever worked with, except her husband. But some. She remembers an incident that happened on the set of Rosemary's Baby, which drove this point home. The cinematographer, Billy Fraker, had set up a shot. It was of Ruth Gordon's character, Mrs. Castavet. She's in Rosemary's apartment, and she asks to use the telephone in the other room. Rosemary tells her to go into the bedroom and make the phone call. So Mrs. Castavet sits on the bed and talks for a moment on the telephone. And the shot was Rosemary's perspective of a quick glance of the old woman in her bedroom making the call. So Billy Fraker set up the camera in the hallway and lined up the camera to shoot Ruth Gordon through the doorway. And the way Fraker lined up the shot, you could clearly see Ruth Gordon framed between the two sides of the door. When Roman looked through the viewfinder, he didn't like it, so he adjusted it. When they did what Roman wanted, Mrs. Castavet wasn't clearly framed. She was obscured by the left side of the doorway. When Sharon looked through the camera viewfinder, she always looked at Roman's shots through the viewfinder. She couldn't understand why Roman changed it. If the shot was meant to be of Mrs. Castavet, it clearly wasn't as good as the earlier one. She was cut in half. The cinematographer couldn't understand it either. But Roman was the director, so Fraker did what he was told. While Roman sat on an apple box sipping coffee from a white styrofoam cup as the camera crew readjusted the camera, Sharon asked him why he changed the shot. Roman just gave her a knowing elfin grin and said, "You'll see." Then he got up and scooted away. Whatever the hell that means, Sharon thought. And she forgot about it till 6 months later. The two of them were together at the very first audience test screening, which was being held at the Alex Theater in Glendale, California. Roman and Sharon sat toward the back of the auditorium holding hands. Roman, who usually liked to sit closer to the screen when he watched other people's movies, likes to sit toward the back when he watched his own, because he was watching the audience even more than he was watching the movie. The cinema was packed. The scene with Mrs. Castavet in Rosemary's apartment came on. Ruth Gordon asks Mia Farrow if she can use the phone in the other room. Mia says yes and points her toward the bedroom. Roman leaned closer to his wife and whispered to her, "You remember when you asked me why I changed the shot?" She had forgotten it, but she remembers now. "Yes." "Watch this," he said, and pointed. But he didn't point at the screen. He pointed instead at the whole sea of heads that sat before them, about 600 of them. On screen, Mia Farrow, as Rosemary, takes a glance at the old woman in her bedroom, and the movie cuts to what she sees, which is the shot of Ruth Gordon as Mrs. Castavet sitting on the bed, talking on the telephone, partially obscured by the left-hand doorframe. Then suddenly, Sharon witnessed all 600 heads in front of her lean slightly to the right in order to see around the doorframe. Sharon let out a small gasp at the sight. Of course, they couldn't see any better by moving their heads. The shot was the shot. Nor did they intellectually know they leaned to the right. They did it instinctively. Sir Roman had manipulated 600 people. And and soon that number would grow to millions all over the world to do something they would never do if they were thinking. But they weren't thinking. Roman was doing their thinking for them. Why did he do it? Because he could. She looked at him, and he gave her that same knowing elfin grin he had given her on the set that day. But this day she understood it. The only thought in her head was, wow! There are times when Sharon knows she didn't just fall in love and marry a good movie director. She fell in love with and married a cinematic Mozart. That was one of those times. Yet the 35mm print that is being projected on the Bruin screen that she's in is about as far away from that level of cinematic artistry as the Earth was to the moon. The Wrecking Crew isn't a film. It's a movie. And it isn't even a good movie. That is, unless you get a laugh out of seeing Dean Martin play Matt Helm. And since this is Dean Martin's fourth Matt Helm movie, apparently a lot of people get a laugh out of seeing Dean Martin play Matt Helm. Dean Martin's deal on the Matt Helm movies was so good that he made more money on the first three than Sean Connery made on the first five Bond movies, which infuriated the Scottish tightwad Connery. As Sharon makes her way down the darkened auditorium aisle looking for a seat, she can see that the scene being projected on the screen is the one of Matt Helm landing in Denmark. Oh, great, she thinks. The hotel scene where she makes her big entrance is next. As she scooches sideways down an empty row, she glances around the dim auditorium. There are about 35 to 40 people scattered around the huge picture palace. As she takes a seat toward the middle of the row, on screen, Dean, as Matt, makes a quip to a sexy stewardess, and the audience laughs. Good, she thinks. They're laughers, and they're enjoying the movie. Sharon removes from her purse the huge glasses she wears whenever she watches a movie. She puts them on and settles into her seat, just as secret agent Matt Helm, dressed in his turtleneck and sport coat ensemble, enters the lobby of the Danish hotel. Two different villainous female spies, Elkie Summer and Tina Louise, keep him under surveillance. As Helm speaks to the Danish desk clerk, T. Louise, speaking in what sounds like it's supposed to be a Hungarian accent, approaches the secret agent, making both contact and a date for later that night. When she slinks away, Matt Helm turns to the desk clerk, quipping in his familiar Dean Martin delivery, "This is some hotel you have here." Enter Sharon Tate as her clumsy character undercover secret agent Freya Carlson. As Sharon stood off camera on location in Denmark, waiting for her director Phil Carlson to call action, she thought back to when she first read the script 5 months earlier. When she heard she was being offered a part in the new Dean Martin Matt Helm secret agent spoof, she naturally assumed she'd be playing a seductive, chic-styled spy film sexpot. And if she'd been offered one of the roles the film's other three leading ladies, Elkie Summer, Nancy Kwan, and Tina Louise, were playing, she would have been correct. But her character, Freya Carlson, was Matt Helm's beautiful but inept and bumbling sidekick. Sharon had already acted in two comedies prior to The Wrecking Crew. The Tony Curtis sex farce, Don't Make Waves, and Roman's film, The Fearless Vampire Killers. But neither comedy allowed her to be funny. While the other actors, Tony Curtis, Roman Polanski, Jack McGowan, in both films ran around maniacally, did pratfalls, and made faces, Sharon was just asked to act vacant and look alluring. Or sexy little me. How ridiculously good she looked in a bikini in Don't Make Waves was played for some comedic effect. But unlike with Lee Taylor Young in I Love You, Alice B. Toklas, the film never took advantage of her character's comic possibilities. But the role of Freya Carlson was different. In this comedy, she was supposed to be the comic relief. Comic relief opposite Dean Martin one of the best light comedians in the business. Also, since her character was a klutz, a performance built around physical comedy, pratfalls, falling in mud puddles, knocking over things, in essence, she was being asked to play the Jerry Lewis part opposite Dean Martin. Sharon jumped at the opportunity. But that was then, this is now. Now, on location in Denmark, standing in the lobby of a Danish hotel, waiting for the director to call action, then make her character's entrance by running into the shot and performing her first comedic pratfall, Sharon was terrified. Not of hurting herself, though she was a little concerned at first of smacking the back of her head against the hard floor of the hotel lobby. The stunt gaffer, Jeff, had told her to tuck her chin into her chest when she fell, and she'd be all right. They slipped a pad under her outfit to protect her keister and the small of her back, and Jeff gave her a few different things to hold in her head. Tuck her chin into her chest as she fell. Keep the champagne bottle in her hand held high during the fall so it didn't shatter against the floor and shower her with glass. Also, the camera would be pointed right up her dress. So if once she hit the floor, her legs go wild, she should close them. But the most terrifying part of all was performing a giant comedic pratfall in front of Jerry Lewis's old partner. As Sharon stood in the wings waiting for her cue to enter, arms loaded down with junk, her head full of things to remember to do, she never felt more at one with a character. Like Freya, she felt out of her depth. Freya as a secret agent, Sharon as a comedian. And intimidated by her more experienced partner, Matt Helm, after James Bond, the world's greatest secret agent, and Dean Martin, one half of one of the screen's greatest comedy teams. Also like Freya, she was eager to do a good job, but also a little afraid of screwing it up. Somebody told her at one point they considered Carol Burnett for the role of Freya. It was obvious why they decided to go a different way, but whether or not they'd regret the way they went would all depend on how Sharon performed this gag. The sweet gentleman, Phil Carlson, who was the director of the picture, told her this was the moment that defined her character for the audience. At one point, there was talk that maybe her character should be introduced as another slinky sex pot, like the other female leads in the film. Then, after the audience judged her by her 60s starlet cover, that's when it would be revealed that she's a comic klutz. But, much to Sharon's delight, Phil rejected that approach. "You're the best character in this whole silly movie," he told her. In fact, Carlson revised the whole idea. Not until mid-movie would her character wear anything even remotely sexy. Her long blonde hair was dyed red and tied up on the back of her head. As opposed to Summer, Quan, and Louise, who are all introduced in outlandish, stylish fashions, Sharon made her entrance in the uniform of a Danish tourist board representative. They stuck big comic glasses on her face, and she spent the